The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
Now we're joined by a father and daughter who are in business together, a business with a musical edge that has brought some of these moments to our screens.
My lover's got humour, she's the giggle at a funeral, knows everybody's disapproval. Should have worshipped her sooner if the heaven.
We only say goodbye with words. I died 100 times. You go back to her, and I go back to her. I go back to her.
It's all down to the thought of her. Maybe it's all down to the loss we learned. Knew for a long time for all it's worth. I wanted to run to you. What if I'm caught up and it's me you're calling? What if I'm lost now plus the demons are coming in?
That was the raw version of the montage there with some familiar voices. Philip King, a father of 5 girls and one of those daughters, Molly, are 2 members of the South Wind Blows team. Molly's triplet sisters are also involved, and their mum, Nuala O'Connor, is a co-founder of the company. They're the people behind films, podcasts, radio, TV shows, and of course, music productions, the likes of other voices that we've just heard. Molly, we heard Amy Winehouse there in that montage from Other Voices. You practically grew up in the business, and it must have been wonderful. Did you meet Amy Winehouse when she was over for that concert?
Yeah, Richard, I did. I grew up with the show. I was 9 years old when it started, so I've been around literally growing up with the show, like you said. And when Amy came to Dingle, she was late and had a very difficult journey with lots of trains and planes. And there was a storm, and our taxi driver, Dermot Begley, picked her up at the airport. And, you know, Amy Winehouse was very petite with a huge beehive. So she had this huge kind of towering beehive on top of her head. But she was a very petite woman, and she was in a little bomber jacket and Nike Air Max and little jeans. And Dermot Begley just turned to her and said, "Where's your mother?" Because he just couldn't quite believe that this was the Amy Winehouse, you know. And she got right off, right out of her taxi, asked for a tube of Pringles and marched straight up onto the stage. And I carried her bags for her up to her room, and she was a consummate professional and, you know, played, I mean, for my money, one of the best performances I've ever seen in my 29 years. So, yeah, it was a really incredible experience, I have to say.
And starting off from the age of 9, did you have a job at the age of 9?
Well, yes. I mean, I was given my first ever job as a 9 or 10 year old was the role of cable bashing. I'm not sure if you're familiar with cable bashing, but basically involves standing kind of or crouching behind a cameraman and making sure his cables don't get tangled as he moves around the stage to record the performances. And at the time, I was very, very small, and I was the only person who could fit behind this really large kind of granite font that was stuck in the church for a long time. So no one really could see me, but I was kind of wrangling cables for a good few years. I was so small that I could fit there. I always said that I had the best seat in the house because I was closest to the stage. So I was very, very proud as a 9 and 10 year old of my little job.
But I'm sure you loved the music. It was a great chance to also meet some of these artists as well. Any particularly memorable moments for you, apart from the Amy Winehouse moment?
I kind of went through many guises of different jobs, and I was a production runner and artist liaison, all sorts of different jobs, which allowed me to interact with artists all the time. And I was sent upstairs to Benner's kind of pre-show, or maybe post-show, with a little tumbler of whiskey for Jarvis Cocker, who had come to perform with Richard Hawley. And he was wearing an astonishingly stylish coat, and he had, you know, his thick-rimmed glasses. And I handed him his whiskey, and he stuck his hand in his inside pocket and said, "Would you like a Weathers original?" And I had a little word as original with Jarvis Cocker, and I kind of, my head was exploding as I spoke to him, and we chatted about Fungi, and we chatted about, you know, Canadian musicians and his love of Leonard Cohen, and as we had our word as original, and all of that was about proximity to music. Like, that's all I wanted. I was completely kind of addicted to being around musicians, and would sit all day to hear sound checks and to be around that atmosphere. So, you know, I've never really gotten sick of it. That's all I've ever wanted to do. I do remember Ellie Goulding coming to Dingle and having a great performance. So she was really nervous and accidentally skipped one of her songs, which is something that happens in the church. These huge artists come and they have to stand up or sit down and perform in front of a really intimate group of people, 80 people. And it's quite a vulnerable situation to find yourself in. So you do see nerves. And she came with a little quartet. And I remember sitting down with her afterwards and talking about kind of how powerful she found the place and the venue. And months later, I was studying for my Leaving Cert mocks. And I got a text saying, "Hey, Molly, it's Ellie Goulding. I'm back in Dingle." And she had just kind of jumped ship from London and come to Dingle with her guitar to write some songs, because she couldn't, kind of had Dingle on the brain. You know, the power of the place in Dingle is so important to the artist, and I think that's what makes one of the reasons that makes Other Voices so attractive to people. It's so beautiful and so remote.
And Philip, did you have any concerns that your daughter at such an early age was hanging out with all of these rock and rollers, or was that part of her musical education?
Well, our house was always filled with music, Richard, one way or the other. There were people visiting, because before we even moved down here in Dublin, people would be coming along. And we were in the world, or in the life, if you like, of having run away to the circus myself as a performer, as a young fella. This was our world. Our world was a musical world, and the lingua franca of our house was music. And it was a very diverse sort of music. So, you know, Donal Lunny could be knocking around, or we might be working with Christy Moore, or we could be working with rock and roll bands. Elvis Costello was living in Dublin at the time, and Elvis and myself had worked together during the Bringing It All Back Home piece. But when the girls were born, he came around to have a look, and he said, "There we are, the Supremes." And he's called them the Supremes ever since, and we're still, you know, in touch, and we're still friends. So from time to time, I would get an email from Elvis that would say, "Hope everything is going well in Ireland," and telling me about music and what he's doing. And then he said, "All the best to the Supremes." So it's just fantastic. Yeah.
Molly, do you have any Supreme-like qualities?
I feel like that's a trick question. But yeah, I mean, I think my supreme-like quality is being one of triplets, which I think is one of my favorite things about myself. So if that can be a supreme quality, I'll pick that one. So,
and for you, Philip, growing up in terms of the family background, were your parents very into music? Where did all of that come from?
I grew up in a musical household myself, Richard, in Cork City, and Cork was a very musical place. You know, Rory Gallagher was around when I was a young fella. Sean O'Riordan's mother lived up the road, Mrs. Reedy in Dorgan's Road, and there was, again, a great diversity of music. There was a sort of a popular music thing in Cork as well, and, you know, there's a musicality in the voice and a sort of an up and downness about it. But the music that fell into my ear at home really came through the medium that we're talking on right now, the warmth and the intimacy of radio. I remember my father coming home on his bike, and on the back carrier of the bike, there was a parcel, a brown paper parcel. And he came in and he unwrapped this. And it was an old, it was a new Pi radio. That's what it was. Plugged in, the valves heated up. I remember the smell of them. The green pilot light in the top right-hand corner of the radio set. And then the magic of turning the dial and tuning in the radio. And it was Radio Éireann, and it was Ciarán MacMahóna, Prunchis Ó Conlóin, and those programmes of pure traditional music. And then turning the dial to 208. Or on Sunday afternoons, I remember my father sitting by the radio and listening to Micheál Ó Hair coming loud and clear in that sharp voice of his that would cut through anything. And as my father got a little bit older, and as the paper began to slump in front of him a little bit as he nodded off on a Sunday afternoon, I just try and reach over him and press the button for the light, the BBC Light radio programme, and turn the dial to listen to Alan Freeman saying, "Hi there, pop pickers." And then my father would suddenly jump up and go back to me all O'Hare.
That was as far as you got.
That was just about as far as I got. But it was, the radio was the thing. And I think the radio has, you know, even in these times now, as again to say, just when we're remote a little bit one from the other, it's just magic.
Scullion and your own career, sure, as a musician with the band and touring with Scullion. I remember going to see Scullion many, many times when I was in college. And I remember I used to go and see them in the Bale Bucked pub Charlemont Street on a Sunday night. You had a sort of a residency there, I think. But what was it like touring around with the band? I mean, very different times, not exactly rock and roll glamour.
Not rock and roll glamour, Richard. I mean, it did have certain attributes that were hugely attractive, but glamour, I don't think was one of them. I mean, there was a great folk club circuit in Ireland, and we used to love that because the intimacy of the venues was wonderful. You know, maybe 400 or 500 people. It was just absolutely wonderful. And then the food was good because they were usually run by committees, and the food would be sort of excellent because you couldn't get any food in Ireland that time. There was no apple greens or any of those sort of things. There was a chipper in called Chicken George's in Port Leash that you might, if you were lucky on the way home, get something to eat. But it was a strange and wonderful world, looking back at it. There was a circuit of venues that you could go to. Then everything changed with the advent of the disco. Bands like ours then would get jobs as being the support to the disco. You'd arrive in Newcastle West, you'd get up on the stage, there'd be six people in a hall that would hold 1,000 people. And I remember one particular night, there were three girls sitting at the lip of the stage looking down the hall. They weren't actually looking at us, they were looking down the hall. And after the third song, one of them turned around and pulled the leg of my trousers and said, "When's the disco starting?" Right? So, like, it was that sort of work. Then 1,000 people.
Not great for the ego, Philip.
No, not great for the ego. 1,000 people arrive in for the chicken and chips. So I think the legislation at the time was you could have a disco, but you had to have a live band on before the disco and you had to serve a hot meal. I think the economics of this for the ballroom owners of the time was really, really excellent. I'd say cash money in plastic bags at the door, excellent.
And Molly, how important was it for you, or was it inevitable that you would have a career in some way in connected to the music business, given that family background?
I think it's just kind of, it's my first memory of kind of knowing what I wanted to be around. So yeah, I just couldn't get enough of it. And Dad, you know, would take me on shoots and, you know, would always have me around sets. And you know, I was kind of helped along by some very patient and generous crew members who taught me how to do various things. And once I kind of started sticking around, that's all I ever really wanted to do.
You went off to study law and you moved to London and you worked in a different job for a time, but ultimately working with your dad and through other voices was where you wanted to be.
Yeah, I moved to London and started working for a ticketing startup. And I think it was important for me, you know, to leave Ireland and also kind of not leave the family firm, but I wanted to be able to go off and work independently and come back with something to offer. And I think I maybe had a little bit of kind of the nepotism chip on my shoulder about, you know, wanting to be able to really offer something new and something helpful to the company. And yeah, so I did that for a number of years, but the tug home was increasingly strong. So yeah, I joined up full time a number of years ago, and you know, that's me now. It's me set. Like I'm kind of ruined for another job. So I'm very happy in the family firm.
And Philip, how important was it for you that some of the children would join you in the firm and stay in the business and help you with that?
it was a gift, really, that we can work together and that we can get on with each other. You know, here's another wonderful thing. You know, I'd be playing music at home and Molly would come home or send me something and sort of say, have you heard this? Have you heard that? You should listen to this. You should listen to that. So it's all about that input all of the time. And having, of course, you know, daughters who are of a different generation, who grew up in a digital world and who access music and who know so much more about the digital universe than I will ever know, is just fantastic. And to be fed a whole new diet of musical delights is just absolutely fantastic.
In Ireland, are we at a point where we supposedly now value culture and music and the arts more than we did, and yet, as a business, as a way of making money, as a way of making a living for artists, it seems as difficult and as challenging as ever?
It is as difficult and as challenging as ever, and that has been brought in sharply into focus by the pandemic and by the situation that artists and all creative people have found themselves in. We need to be where knowledge is created. I think businesses, and I don't know whether you would agree with this, Richard, want to come to places where knowledge is created. And what I see in the let's call it the STEM argument, not just the solely science, technology, engineering and maths, but inserting the A of arts into that, the thing that is going to differentiate us as a place and as an offering, and what with the changes and the challenges that are coming with the tax issues around FDI and all of that, we are going to have to grow and own and monetize our own intellectual property that we create and that we make here. And artists are people who do that on a consistent basis.
But do you think in terms of education, you mentioned about the STEM and the technical stuff,
sure.
are we want to compete with other countries,
yes,
other
do.
Economies, we want to have people for the suitably qualified for where the future is in technology and all of that. Do you think there's a danger that we might embrace the STEM too much and leave out some of that history and creativity for music, for culture, for arts?
Well, I think we would do that at our peril, because if we have a resource, which we do, a brilliant natural resource of imagination, which is manifest in us as Irish people, why would we leave that to one side? Why would we exclude that? If the universities are going to be the silos out of which wonderful new intellectual property can come, it would seem to me as a layperson that we should be investing much, much more significantly in the higher education piece and going about this in a far more strategic way.
Well, Philip and Molly King, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.